Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It was the scream that was heard around the world.
And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House! Yeah!
That is Howard Dean from 10 years ago this month delivering an impassioned speech after placing third in the Iowa caucus. Pundits and late-night hosts called it a crazy red-faced rant. Didn't matter that he was hoarse and speaking in a very noisy room. The isolated audio of the so-called Dean scream helped destroy his fledgling candidacy. More recently, Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman came under fire for his exuberant remarks with a reporter after winning the NFC Championship. New York Congressman Michael Grimm picked up the rage mantle for threatening to throw a New York One reporter off a balcony just last week. Our aversion to passionate outbursts is not unprecedented. According to William Harris, director of Columbia University's Center for the Ancient Mediterranean, even Homer and Plato were preoccupied with emotional control. Harris is author of the book Mental Disorders in the Classical World and is currently researching mental disorders in the times of the Greeks and the Romans. William Harris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
So what would Stoics have thought of Howard Dean or Richard Sherman?
They would have been very disapproving, no question about that. In general, Stoics would have thought that that was a serious moral failing, and displays of anger in particular were to be avoided by all sensible human beings.
That's so interesting to me because I think of classical antiquity and projecting strength and great impassioned oratory. Did they see a distinction between strength and rage?
Oh, yes. Rage is a particular problem. As you said, it starts very early on with Homer, and it goes on all the way through classical antiquity. And one of the reasons why I studied this phenomenon was because it's so much an obsession of theirs. And partly that's to do with the whole business of constructing a city-state and how people are going to behave. So, it's all very well for people to argue about politics and to scream a little bit like Howard Dean, but people have to observe limits in the way that they are going to display their anger. Otherwise, eventually you end up with civil war. And another problem is to do with slavery, because much as we may admire the Greeks and Romans, we have to face the fact that they all lived in slave societies. Some were more dependent on slavery than others, but all of them had slaves. And the situation of slaveholder versus slave is one which is full of potential anger, fairly obviously. And if you're going to manage it in a slave society, you need to be able to control the anger of the slaves, but you need also to be able to control your own anger, because if you lose your temper with your slaves too much, well, they bide their time and they get their revenge. And this is a Greek and Roman idea which gave rise to lots of practical thinking about how to control anger.
That is fascinating. So they were sort of modeling moderation from the top so that there wouldn't be unrest among the plebs. I mean, this sounds like it's coming from very top down. Any indication of how emotional extremes were regarded among the citizens?
Oh, yes. And not only among citizens, but among slaves. You're perfectly right that the writings that we're talking about are top down. So emotional control as an ideal spread down to a lot of the rest of the population. But at the same time, of course, ordinary people could get very angry, whether we're talking about classical Athens or classical Rome, late Republican Rome, and people had lots of grievances and could get very angry about them. And you might say that without that anger, there would never have been very much reform. So there is a social divide, as you're hinting.
Did the ideal of emotional control, was that focused on rage, or was it any kind of passionate extreme?
Oh, as far as the Stoics are concerned, it's any kind of passion, any kind of pathos. That's their word for it. So The ideal Stoic would have been a very cold fish, in fact, because he or she would not have approved of, let's say, ardent expressions of love either, or in any other emotion. The Stoics were aware of the fact that practically no human being could ever become an ideal Stoic, though. They knew that the wise man, that's their ideal person, is a pretty rare creature.
Well, I know you've spent a lot of time studying this, and I did a very sort of peripheral read of what you do, but they sound to me like control freaks, obviously, but it wasn't just like a sort of, I don't know, neuroses. Rage was actually considered an illness at that time. How did the ancients treat that? Did they see it as something that could be corrected or fixed?
They saw it as something that could be corrected, but as far as rage is concerned, for example, they were very heavily dependent on self-control. And the most interesting ancient authority on this subject is the 2nd century AD physician Galen, who has left us a huge amount of writing, including a treatise in which he explains as well as he can how you control rage. And essentially, you need to be continuously vigilant. And if you feel that rage is coming on, you need to try to exercise control. And you don't make any exceptions for yourself. And you have to get into training. Obviously, this kind of thing only helps with rather mild kinds of mental disorders. It doesn't help with, you know, extreme schizophrenia or anything of that kind. But there's some good advice in Galen, I think, and to some extent in other ancient writers as well.
We're speaking with William Harris, professor of history at Columbia University, and also a researcher who's done a lot of work looking at mental disorders in the classical world. I'm curious about your research into this because the language is completely different. The regard for, you know, the sort of ciphers and the prophets and the people who spoke out of turn is completely different. How do you find evidence of mental disorders in the ancient world?
Oh, it's all over the place. And it's there already in Homer. And one of the reasons why I study this phenomenon is because the Greeks and Romans talk about it so much. Greeks in particular. Already in Book 20 of the Odyssey, there is a bizarre scene of hallucination, rather complicated one to explain, but this is obviously a phenomenon that Homer is very interested in, and it goes on all the way through antiquity. So this is a big feature of their culture, and starting in the 5th century BC with the Hippocratic doctors, there's a really epoch-making change that comes about because some Greeks start trying to give rational explanations of mental disorders without reference to the gods. And prior to that, Greeks, like many other early peoples, tended to attribute mental disorders to divine intervention of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the ancient world, lots of people continued to do that. It's enough to read the New Testament to see that. But at the same time, there are doctors and philosophers who are trying to explain things in what we could call, just to summarize it, a more rational fashion.
Well, Professor Harris, is that something that we might describe today as schizophrenia? I mean, can we apply our contemporary paradigms of mental illness to those displays?
Well, only with tremendous caution, I think. I've fairly frequently, during this research, been to encounters of various kinds with psychiatrists, and I'm trying to keep up to date as far as it's possible for an outsider to do so, with the literature in that field. And as I'm sure that many of your listeners know, the categories that we use nowadays for mental disorders are very much under discussion and under dispute. We haven't, mastered this field altogether. And so to apply diagnosis in modern terms to somebody who lived in antiquity is a very tricky business. And whenever, you know, I read in books that the Emperor Caligula was a schizophrenic or something of that kind, I want to put on the brakes. It's true that our categories are probably better than the categories which the Greeks and Romans used, but they are still very problematic.
Do you ever wonder, as an historian who's looking back through thousands of years, how historians of the future will look back at our contemporary society and describe our mental illness and treatment?
Well, I hope, in a sense, that they will be able to look back and think that psychiatry and the study of mental disorders was still, in 2014, at a pretty early stage of its development, and that they will be a bit complacent about the fact that they've learned a lot more. I'm not necessarily predicting that this will happen, but that's what I would hope will happen. And, of course, you know, in our own lifetimes, we've seen very important developments in psychiatric diagnosis. The most obvious and most famous one is that in an earlier edition of the DSM, if we go back the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, if we go back 40 years, homosexual desire was regarded as a serious disorder, and there was a lot about that. And in the more recent editions of the DSM, that, of course, has disappeared completely. So, you know, the real change, progress, I think, has taken place. That was only one example. There are others as well of how, let's say, the official scheme for diagnosing mental disorders has changed.
William Harris, thank you for opening up this window into the ancient world for us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
William Harris, Professor of History and Director of Columbia University Center for the Ancient Mediterranean. You can find out more on his research and specifically on his book, Mental Disorders in the Classical World, by going to wordofmouthradio.org. If the philosophers of antiquity elevated the art of restraint, then Sylvester Graham would have made an exceptional Stoic. Up next on Word of Mouth, the surprising story of the Presbyterian minister who invented the graham cracker and why he would be aghast at its sinfully sweet modern version. Stay with us for that story and more Word of Mouth after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sylvester Graham would have hated the s'more. The inventor of the graham cracker was no ordinary food entrepreneur. He was the fervent leader of one of America's first big diet trends. Only Graham's strict regimen of bland food was not about losing weight or lowering cholesterol. The graham cracker was part of a health movement designed to squelch America's sexual urges. Here to tell us more about this forgotten bit of food history is Adi Braun, who wrote about Sylvester Graham for The Atlantic. Hello, Adi.
Hi, Virginia.
So tell us more about Sylvester Graham and what led him to prominence as a 19th century health guru.
Yeah, so Sylvester Graham was an evangelical reverend in America during the first half of the 19th century in the Northeast. He came out of these social and health reform movements that were gaining popularity at the time. So the temperance movement, the early feminists, the abolitionists, this was pre-Civil War America, the people promoting kind of alternative health and lifestyles, like anti-tobaccoist, anti-caffeine. He came out of this, and he really made a name for himself initially by giving these very fiery speeches to young men, warning them against the dangers of masturbation. And this was based on his theories of human physiology. So Graham believed that the more exciting and therefore the more immoral the sexual act, the worse it was for your health. So he had this kind of sliding scale of sexual depravity. On the one end, you had marital sex, which was the most innocuous, and that was okay, but only once a month, because beyond that was excessive and pathological. And on the other hand, you had self-stimulation, which was, in Graham's mind, the most exciting, and therefore the most harmful. And in fact, he blamed the cholera epidemic of 1832 in part to these excessive sexual behaviors. Out of this, he began to expand his view on the excesses that were really a problem in American society at the time. And he saw gluttony as part of this, commercialization, materialism. And so out of these ideas about reining in excess and repressing people's sexual urges, he formulated a comprehensive lifestyle plan, which he called the Graham System of Living. At the heart of this system was the Graham Diet. It prohibited the drinking of alcohol, you know, no tobacco, no caffeine, no spices. That was too exciting for him, and no meat. Graham was one of the fathers of the early American vegetarian movement, and the diet really consisted of fruits, vegetables, a little bit of dairy, and whole wheat. And whole wheat became increasingly important to Graham.
Among those staples that he took issue with was white bread. What was his opposition?
Yeah, so white bread was really a problem for Graham. What was happening at the time was the era of early industrialization, and with it came the beginnings of the commercial food industry. And so there wasn't a whole lot of regulation going on. There was a fair amount of adulteration. And all of these additives were being put into the white bread, copper, alum, clay, chalk, all these things to make it whiter and also to extend its shelf life. You know, Graham may have been exaggerating the health crisis a bit, so much so, in fact, that he wrote an entire a book about how to make homemade bread out of whole wheat flour. And whole wheat flour, Graham was convinced, would restore Americans to health. Whole wheat flour, you know, gave the teeth a workout. It led to a healthy colon, you know, a healthy, strong colon. So he had all these ideas about the health benefits of whole wheat. And so he wrote his book laying out in very careful detail not only how to make homemade bread, but how to make whole wheat flour. And he called the whole wheat flour Graham flour, and his Graham bread. And that eventually became what we know today as Graham crackers. But, you know, of course, his bread had no sugar or spices in it. And, of course, Graham crackers today include those ingredients. And it's also a commercial product. So
Graham's countering of our animalistic desires that were getting the better of us gave rise to the Graham cracker, now a Nabisco-branded snack. You write that his lifestyle advice included some pretty sensible advice. What else besides Graham crackers did Sylvester Graham prescribe?
His lifestyle plan was pretty ascetic. You know, he advocated for pretty radical health and hygiene habits, you know, getting regular exercise and bathing regularly, getting fresh air and drinking fresh water, also wearing loose clothing. You know, he believed that tight-fitting clothing was bad for the body, going to bed at this very prescribed time, getting up early. I mean, it was all about the rituals of the day and making sure that people weren't straying too far from it. It was a very restrictive way of life.
How popular was this, sounds pretty bland, but somewhat sensible regimen?
Yeah, it was sensible, but, you know, he was kind of an extremist. I mean, but he definitely had his followers. I mean, he was a guru of his day, and he was especially popular amongst the middle classes, even though he was really targeting the poor. You know, his popularity lasted a few years, really, in the sort of early to mid-1830s, before I think he became even too extreme for his Grahamites, as they called themselves, his followers. But yeah, he wrote regularly. He published often. He was an exceptional orator, so his lectures were really popular. So yeah, I mean, he was a big deal for a bit there.
You write also about one very notable Grahamite, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, a name familiar to all of us. What did he do with Graham's prescriptions?
Yeah, so Graham died in 1851, I believe. So fast forward about 40 years, and in Battle Creek, Michigan, it was a health spa, and it was run by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, who was a Graham disciple, and he was always concocting these new food products, and he was kind of tooling around the kitchen one day and created this cereal. He served it to his patients, went over quite well, and he started marketing it, and eventually that became known as cornflakes.
Who would you likely compare Sylvester Graham to today? Would he be more food guru and author Michael Pollan, or the evangelical leader Pat Robertson?
Probably a combination of both. I mean, I would say that the thing that really separates Graham from somebody like Michael Pollan is he's a bit of an extremist. You know, I mean, he was all about this very regimented diet. And it certainly was linked to religion, but I would say less so than in evangelical ministers that we have today. You know, his diet was more along the lines of these kind of fad diets, you know, the paleo diet, South mm-hmm. Beach diet, the baby food diet. Even Atkins, I would say, is more kind of similar to what he was promoting.
Adi Braun, thank you for opening up this really odd chapter of history for us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Adi Braun, she's written for NPR, for Lapham's Quarterly, and The Atlantic, where you can find her recent article on the 19th century food guru, Sylvester Graham. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. The Netflix original documentary Mitt has generated a lot of buzz for humanizing failed presidential candidate Mitt Romney. But it's not the only film you should put in your queue. Up next, a look at the top 25 documentaries now streaming on Netflix.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
So what do you say if we... What do you think you say in a concession speech?
That is a clip from the new Netflix original documentary, Mitt, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential politics from the campaign of 2012 Republican nominee Mitt Romney. Not surprisingly, Mitt has gotten a lot of attention in the press lately. But if you are not ready to reflect on the 2012 election, there are many other documentaries available through Netflix instant streaming service. The hardest part is knowing which ones are worth it. Ross Scarano is deputy editor at Complex, where he's compiled a list of the 25 best documentaries streaming on Netflix. Ross, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to be here.
And let's just establish that neither you nor I are being paid to plug Netflix, but this is just a terrific source of watching documentaries, among other things.
It is. You know, if anything, the need for the list maybe points out some problems that Netflix has with recommendations. So maybe it's not a plug after all.
Well, let's start off with some recommendations for somebody who's not likely to watch Mitt, for example. Any lighter, funnier, or more cultural options for Netflix subscribers looking for a good documentary?
I'm a huge fan of Bill Cunningham, New York.
Oh, I loved that one.
So it came out in 2010. It's a documentary about Bill Cunningham, who is the on-the-street style photographer for the New York Times and has been for many, many years.
He rides his bike around and takes photographs of people, and usually women, in mm-hmm. stylish outfits and finds a theme.
Yeah, and he's an amazing figure because he's kind of like this fashion monk where he lives this very like ascetic lifestyle. So he's just this amazing New York character, and his story is really inspiring and also melancholy at times because he's led such a solitary life.
So that's Bill Cunningham, New York. Anything else?
I also really like Room 237. It's basically a study of Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining, his mm-hmm. horror movie, the Stephen King adaptation. The documentary takes the form of interviews with a number of people who have obsessively studied the film and have all sorts of theories about what the movie might actually be about, and they range in terms of credibility. You know, you have some people who are actual film scholars and other people who have just spent a lot of time in their living room watching the movie. It's funny. It's weird. It's just an interesting way of thinking about what a documentary can be and what a movie can be.
And that's Room 237. And we will have a full list of Ross's choices for documentaries to watch on Netflix at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Another doc getting a lot of attention on Netflix. This is called The Queen of Versailles. This came out in 2012, about a family that made huge money in the timeshare business and set about creating an over-the-top replica of the palace at Versailles. And halfway through construction, they lost everything in the financial collapse. Here's just a clip.
If we had to buy just a normal house, like $300,000 house, four-bedroom house, I would be fine with that. Make it work. Just get a bunch of bunk beds, you know.
The Queen of Versailles, both hilarious and somewhat maddening to watch. As what are some more serious, hard-hitting documentaries available on Netflix right now?
Well, the one that I'm probably most excited about and the one I recommend the most often is a film that came out last year that's up for an Academy Award this year. It's called The Act of Killing.
Mm-hmm.
It was directed by an American named Joshua Oppenheimer, who found himself in Indonesia where there was a genocide in the 60s. And he wanted to make a film about this. And so being a sort of like compassionate person, he was like, well, I want to interview the survivors and the families of survivors. But because the regime that perpetrated the genocide is still in power, he found that it was very difficult to do that. It was compromising the safety of the people he was interviewing and his own safety. And then so in a really perverse, ugly turn, he found out that the easiest way to get people to talk about it was to talk to the people responsible for it. And then so the film that he ended up producing is it's something akin to interviewing Nazis today had the Nazis won World War II.
So that's The Act of Killing. This is nominated for Best Documentary Feature. Let's hear another one from your list. This one is called Blackfish. It's a 2012 documentary that takes a critical look at SeaWorld and the danger of one killer whale in particular, which caused the deaths of several SeaWorld trainers.
Avulsion, laceration, abrasion, fractures, fractures and associated hemorrhages, blunt force traumas to the main body, to the extremities. To see this meted out against a trainer, and I cannot fathom the reason. It's shocking. The lawyer for OSHA asked me what I thought we'd learned, and I'm sitting in the courtroom, and I've got the Kelty Byrne case file in one hand, and I've got Don Bradshaw in the other, and they're almost to the day 20 years apart, and I'm looking at these two things. My only answer is nothing.
Clip there from the film Blackfish, a documentary that's available for streaming on Netflix. Ross Scarano has compiled a list of the 25 best documentaries that you can watch on Netflix. And that's something that I've read recently, Ross, about documentary films being like the new muckraking journalism, that this is the forum where a lot of people who spend a lot of time and energy digging up facts, investigating interesting stories, have a forum. What do you think is going on in documentaries right now?
Well, I think that for the same reason that, you know, more and more independent small films are made every year and then published on places like YouTube, it's just become cheaper to make movies than it ever has been before. I feel like documentaries are the perfect form in many ways to open someone's eyes to something that's happening, for instance, like at SeaWorld, you know, places that they've probably been but didn't really understand what was going on behind the scenes. There's nothing better than to show someone footage of that.
Well, no self-respecting list of great documentaries would be complete without this voice.
These images are memories of long-forgotten dreams. Is this their heartbeat or ours?
Clip there from The Cave of Forgotten Dreams by director Werner Herzog. Any other good Herzog documentaries on Netflix right now, Ross?
Werner Herzog is a superhero and one of my favorite people. It's sad they just took Grizzly Man off not too long ago. That's one of my favorites. But you can watch Into the Abyss, his documentary about death row in Texas that came out a few years ago. It's a very sobering film.
Grizzly Man's gone. How often does Netflix swap out content?
Well, you know, it's all about the sort of licensing agreements they make with studios, and they aren't entirely forthcoming about that information. The lineup changes every week. Will be some titles removed every week and also titles added, but like I said, they don't make all that information available.
Well, Ross, we generally think of documentaries as something that engage the mind in an intellectual way, or we're learning something. Any guilty pleasure documentaries come to mind for you?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, it's not a guilty pleasure. I don't feel bad about watching it, but Style Wars. It's about graffiti in the early days of hip-hop in New York in the 1980s, and it's just so much fun to watch. It has all these weird appearances from graffiti writers and from, like, Ed Koch, who was the mayor at the time, and just so many amazing, beautiful shots of New York in the 80s. When it's dirty but also weirdly gorgeous, it's a lot of fun.
Well, Ross, thank you for the recommendations. I was really looking for something to do before House of Cards starts.
Now you have plenty of options.
Ross Scarano, deputy editor at Complex, where he compiled a list of the 25 best documentaries now streaming on Netflix. There's a link to the complete list at wordofmouthradio.org. Among Complex Magazine's list of the best documentaries now streaming on Netflix is the film A Band Called Death. It's about three teenage brothers from Detroit who formed a band in the 1970s, which isn't so unusual. The home of Motown gave birth to a number of bands that made it, and many, many more that didn't. This band was unusual for another reason. Producer Mercedes Mejia has the story. Have you heard
the bell in The name of this band is Death, and they're often described as the first black punk band.
See, we grew up in the black community, so at that time, people were tuning in to like groups like Earth, Wind & Fire.
And, you know, here we are in the middle of all of this playing rock and roll.
And, I mean, it was just, it wasn't a rock and roll culture. White boy music.
You heard from Bobby and Danis Hackney in a clip from the film A Band Called Death. The film tells an unbelievable story about how the band languished in obscurity for decades before stumbling into sudden fame. When Death began playing Detroit clubs in the 1970s, no one was prepared for the proto-punk sonic attack the brothers unleashed on stage. But drummer Danis Hackney says they were just playing the music they loved.
When people say, oh, you know, you pioneered punk music and you did this and you did that, we weren't trying to pioneer anything.
Yeah.
We were just fighting for our identity.
That's right. And, you know, back in the 70s, if you call somebody a punk, I mean, that was fighting words. You got a bloody nose for that.
That's Bobby Hackney, bassist and vocalist. His lyrics captured the political rage that typified the punk movement. The number one biggest game with the kingdom of fame. Like a ring at the top because they want to be boss. They don't care who they step on as long as they get along. Politicians and my eyes. In 1975, Death looked like it was on the brink of a record deal. But the band had a problem. Bobby Hackney says a record company executive told them this.
You guys might have a record deal if you are willing to change the name.
But the late David Hackney, the band's guitar player and leader, was unwilling to change the name. In a decidedly punk move, Dave said he wasn't going to sell out. So they put out their own 45. But it never took off. David Hackney died in 2000. But before he died, he told his brothers one day the world would come looking for their music.
Tell me, what do you guys think of all this attention you're getting right now?
It's wonderful. We love it. We love it. But, you know, it's what our brother David predicted. And that's what kind of makes it weird. I keep looking in the corner to see Rod Sterling smoking a cigarette talking about the Twilight Zone.
In 2008, a friend of Bobby's son was raving about some great music she discovered. Turns out, it was his dad's band. Bobby Jr. had no idea about the band Death.
I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. Like, my eyes started to tear up. The hairs were, like, standing up on the back of my neck. I started shaking. Or am I freaking out?
Death's story spread like wildfire, and the documentary was soon underway.
Hey.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
At a screening of the film, Stephanie Christian says she sees her own life reflected in the band's story.
Me being a black rock artist, like, this just solidifies that what I'm doing may not necessarily be everybody's cup of tea, but I'm not going to stop doing it because it's what I love.
The remaining brothers are now on tour, promoting the movie and opening for bands like Metallica. And they give a lot of credit to their late brother, who stuck to his punk beliefs.
Sitting here in this chair today, I'm saying, thank you, Dave. I'm glad that you didn't want that for us.
Yeah. The only bittersweet thing is that we wish that he was here to share it all with us. And he is with us in spirit, but we just wish that he was here, you know.
One, two, three, now!
Our thanks to producer Mercedes Mejia for that piece about Detroit's all-black proto-punk band, Death. What happens when Shakespeare's Othello, the sound of Motown and modern dance combine? An electrifying performance the New York Times calls one of the most compelling dance creations of the century. We'll speak with choreographer Doug Elkins when Word of Mouth continues. The number one biggest game is with the kingdom of fame. It's like a race at the top because they want to be boss. They don't care who they step on as long as they get up. Word of
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. They are songs that come out at just about every boomer of a certain age's dance party or wedding. James Brown, anything Motown, Motown-inspired, and a few Memphis Soul numbers from Stax Records. These AM radio hits of yesterday get remixed with a little more bass and new layers of jealousy, obsession, and meaning in a performance the New York Times called one of the most compelling dance creations of this century. Tonight, Doug Elkin's dance brings Moortown Redux to Keene State College's Redfern Art Center on Brickyard Point. The famed choreographer's company will also present the world premiere of a piece called Hapless Bazaar. And on the line to talk more about this pairing is Doug Elkins, two-time Bessie Award winner, Guggenheim Fellow, and now faculty member at Rutgers University. Doug Elkins, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's so funny listening to these. I wonder about the challenge of using songs that are so familiar to us, which you give really new life, here expanding on the storyline of Shakespeare's Othello and a previous dance on this theme. Can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of the idea?
Yeah. One of the other things that I do professionally is I do movement and fight choreography for plays in New York City. So I was doing the movement and fight scenes for production of Othello. But it also had its gestation in an earlier version. I've been looking at a production of a famous film of a classic work by choreographer José Limón, his work, The Moor's Pavane. I've been watching the Pavane, and then I started bouncing around YouTube and looking at, oddly enough, one of the early versions of The Temptations singing and dancing to My Girl. And I realized that the backup dancing that they were doing was a kind of pavane itself, kind of slow, stately march. As I kept looking through the Motown songbook, I started thinking that one could actually do a whole retelling of Othello as though it were performed on Soul Train.
So,
for want of a better description.
Well, it's such a good one. And this in itself is a retelling of Othello, which is probably a retelling of some old story from the past. Can you give us just a little bit of a primer on the four principal dancers here, the characters there, Othello, the Moor?
Yes. By the way, you are right. It is even Shakespeare's telling. It's a retelling of a story that has from 300 years earlier called The Moorish Captain.
Uh-huh.
But the characters are the four central characters from Othello. It is the Moor, or Othello, his friend, who may or may not be his friend, Iago, the Moor's wife and paramour, Desdemona, and Iago's wife, Emilia. I kind of geeked out on everything Othello when researching it and kept coming back to the thing that I love about Limón's version is it's almost like a kind of Japanese kabuki play. You kind of follow the path of the handkerchief that he offers to Desdemona as a kind of proposal or an engagement present, and it tells the story.
Well, and it is also the story of perhaps the only black character in all of the Shakespeare plays, or there's some question about what color he was. He's called a Moor, mm-hmm. which is the euphemism for Ethiopian at that time, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder, you know, they're dancing, at least initially, kind of joyfully to these songs that are emblematic of romantic innocence. And Motown was also black music cleaned up for white American teens. Is race any subtext of this story for you?
Very much. I kind of made it in the wake also of, you know, other things going on at the time, the election of Barack Obama, and also it's inherent in the music. Like you said, it's crossover music. I remember coming across a quote by James Baldwin from Notes of a Native Son that kind of led me into it. And the quote is, "It is only in his, the Negro's music, which Americans are able to admire, because a protective sentimentality limits their understanding of it, that the Negro in America has been able to tell his story." And it was a kind of lead into playing with the ideas involved in it. Hmm. And it's also part of the thing of the text. As you go further into the plot, for instance, there's a whole scene between, in our version, between Othello and Iago, where Iago reveals the handkerchief is basically stolen from Desdemona to implicate her as someone having an affair. The music used is James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose.
Let's hear a little bit of the remix of Give It Up and Turn It Loose here with little bits of Heard It Through the Grapevine slipping in for this pivotal scene, this face-off between Othello and Iago. And that is from a performance of Moortown Redux from the Baryshnikov Art Center. Well, luckily tonight, Doug Elkins Dance is going to be bringing that production here to New Hampshire, to Keene State College's Redfern Art Center. I want to get back to that sort of idea of what you're bringing to this, because Moortown Redux updates this dance by Jose Limon with this athleticism and bravado of hip-hop moves. And from what I can see, especially when the men face off, a little bit of samba, a little bit of the Brazilian martial arts, capoeira. And I'm thinking about your own traditions of your dance career. You began as a b-boy break dancing. So what are you adding to this ongoing conversation about Othello?
It's to kind of be in dialogue. There's a great quote by John Cage, and I think I'm paraphrasing him. He says, "History is not a fact. History is merely a field with a lot of stuff in it." And the nature of my own dance background is one of gleaning, of a kind of appropriating and sampling and layering from my background as a b-boy, as a house head, a house dancer, even playing capoeira. There's a sense of improvising with what you have.
After Superbad, after this confrontation, we hear this incredibly spare recording of Marvin Gaye singing I Heard It Through the Grapevine, and he is just writhing in his obsessive jealousy. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
Ooh, I bet you're wondering how I knew about your plans to make me blue with some other guy. You knew before, between the two of us guys, you know I love you more. It took me by surprise, I must say, when I found out yesterday. Don't you know that I heard through the grapevine?
Oh, I'm just so struck. Without all the trimmings, I never really heard the anguish in that song. Do you think that's going to give people a different understanding of this story or of this song?
I think if I've been successful in some way, it's if you've never seen the or read the Othello version before or seen Morse Pavan, you would still get the homeopathic essence of the story.
Well, Doug Elkins, we look forward to seeing it. And thanks so much for bringing this to New Hampshire.
Well, thanks for having me, Virginia. Thank you very much.
Doug Elkins, a two-time Bessie Award winner, Guggenheim Fellow. He's currently on the faculty at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Tonight, Doug Elkins' dance performs Moortown Redux, named one of the 10 best dance performances of 2013 by the New York Times, along with the world premiere of Hapless Bazaar. That's all at Keene State College's Redfern Art Center on Brickyard Point, beginning at 7:30. For details, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. As we say goodbye today, some news about BJ Novak, who I'll be speaking with next Tuesday for Writers on a New England Stage. He is a writer and director who you may know best as the temp Ryan on NBC's comedy The Office.
Oh, I need my entourage. Jim, Dwight, Ryan, come on, we're going to Asian Hooters.
Oh man, I can't.
Why not?
I'm not feeling so well. I got a ton of work to do here. MSG allergy, peanut allergy. I just ate there last night.
Feel better.
Thanks.
Wow. Thanks for taking all the excuses, dude.
Doctor appointment, car trouble, plantar warts. Granddad fought in World War II. He's your head man.
Today, BJ's book One More Thing comes out in hardcover. It's a collection of, honestly, laugh-out-loud short stories that he has already started to release on Instagram. Yep, that's a book on the photo-sharing site Instagram. It was also announced today that BJ Novak has been cast as the villainous Alistair Smythe in the upcoming, sure-to-be-mega-blockbuster, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. There are still tickets available for BJ's appearance at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, but they're going quickly. For more information on the event, you can go to musichall.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of mouth will be back tomorrow with the very best of our Rethink 2014 series. That's tomorrow at 2 and again at 9 on Word of Mouth from NHPR. No one in my life, you see, 'cause you're